Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to the first Royal Automobile Club talk show in association with Motorsport of 2017. We've got a fantastic lineup of talk shows this year, and starting things off, we are joined by the legend that is Tom Christensen. Tom, thank you so much for joining us. Extremely kind.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Also joining me is Jack Phillips, making his podcast debut, the online content assistant at Motorsport Magazine, and of course, Alan Hyde, the wizard behind the mixer. Who makes us all sound a lot better than we do in real life. Tom, you a very busy few days for you. You're off to Race Retro tomorrow. You're very kindly joining us now, but you've also been at the club's annual dinner last night.
Yeah, it was a very nice event. 160 people, black tie dinner. John Heinhoff interviewed me kindly and obviously very, very, very good on the stage. So in this building, which has so much history, and when you're walking around here, you absolutely feel a lot of the heritage from our great sport.
And when we walked in this morning, you couldn't miss the R10. That amazingly, these cars, they get through the front door, up the stairs, and in. Does it still give you sort of, you know, when you see the old cars that, you know, it's the R15. When you see them, do you get a little twinge of kind of history and all that?
Yeah, it's lovely to see it. But actually, when I arrived, you know, they said, "Welcome to the Royal Automobile Club, sir. And could I help you with your parking?" And I said, "No, thank you. It's done." And they didn't quite get the joke, but I mean, it's for sure something which I. It's not the car I actually drove. It's actually the winning car that year, 2010. But certainly. It's some of the cars which I really, really like. Yeah.
And those that are watching on the video rather than just listening to the audio, you will see that we have Tom's book, which is called The Book. It's absolutely amazing, 3.5 kilogram sort of photo history of Tom's life. And then sitting on top of the book, we have this goblet from the club that is given to each guest who comes to the annual motoring dinner.
Yeah, in retirement, I was very surprised that after the they gave me a trophy. So getting a trophy, a nice one, absolutely, it's very nice.
Now, looking into sort of your history and things, there's a big anniversary this year, and it's 20 years since that first Le Mans, your first win. Does it feel like 20 years? I mean, because so much has happened in between, but...
No. In short, it doesn't. But obviously, in these two decades, when you look about what the race is, what we have done, it has been a very, very busy 20 years. But it has been a fantastic journey. But no, 20 years ago, arriving first time to Le Mans, and you know, it's a little bit similar experience. Like, you know, when you arrive at Le Mans, that poor, that's a great circuit. You feel that. You know, what's all the heritage and the history when you are walking around, when you come there first time. So for sure, you are very kind of concentrated, starstruck. You know you have a chance, which you have to do well. You get an opportunity, and you have to grab it with both hands and more.
And your teammates that year, Alboreto and Stefan Johansson, they were sort of... They were. I mean, obviously, you had your experience in Formula 3000, and you know you're working your way up the motorsport ladder. Was it daunting being dropped into that team at the last second with drivers like that?
Yeah, it was. But again, I felt it really much like an opportunity to do well. But I mean, to arrive and to get the call 2 days before the race, because pre-testing was done. It was fantastic. To make it short, I got the call from Ralf Jüttner on the Thursday evening if I was interested to drive at Le Mans, and I was playing tennis. It was just the mobile phones were just started at that time, and
yes, I could be interested.
And then I the next day I flew down to Joerst, and the team had just left for Le Mans, so sort of the facility was pretty empty. But after we did a letter of intent, and the secretary of Sigrun at the time was doing the contract, we went downstairs and they showed me the premises. There was one monocoque in the corner, and one of the mechanics were there, me and Reinhold Joerst, and they said, jump in it. It was the chassis we used last year. And I think it's even Michele Seed, I heard with the mechanic say. So I sort of got that, jumped in, and I sit perfectly in this one. And they sort of looked at me, you know, I was getting a little bit too... if the brake pedal could come a little bit back, then it would be perfect for me. And then the mechanic, I mean, he bent over to me and sort of wanted to whisper me something, but he then say, in our team, der schnellste bestimmt. In our team, the fastest decide. And I was like, oh, I thought I blew it. But anyway, I got the contract, and to cut it a bit short, meeting Michele and Stefan was fantastic. They really embraced me in the team, of saying that how happy they were that I was joining them, not telling me what to do, but by giving me a lot of support and giving me that they have seen and heard what I did in Japan, what I did in 3000, they really helped me, and I felt good. And then I started asking, what are you doing in this corner? Because there was no telemetry back then. You know, it was really, which gear you used there? And Michele was, I don't know, second or third? I don't know completely. But all right. But, and, you know, they, of course, they started to think of that as well, and gave me very good feedback. I did 17 time laps in practice. And I think your colleague Simon Aaron must have met me in the evening after I did my first stints, because I have a Betamax video of that, and I sound hilarious. I sound like I'm on helium, having just experienced driving into the sunset, and with the passing of the slower cars, and I speak very, very fast, and I did pretty well in two stints, but I was not blindingly fast. That came in the night. After in my third stint, suddenly it was different than when Ralf Jüttner told me to pit stop, pit in, next lap, fuel only. Then suddenly he came on the radio and said, schnellste Runde, Tom, schnellste Runde, du hast die schnellste Runde gemacht, sehr schön, sehr gut. And that was pretty good. And driving at night.
For those ignorant people like myself who don't speak German. What was he saying on the radio? Sorry.
He was saying that I did the fastest race lap, and doing that into the third stint at Le Mans, being there with so few laps before the race, was fantastic. Shortly later, I got a clear lap, and to be honest, in my 18 years at Le Mans, I've not had 10 clear laps, and to have one in your first race was fantastic. Because when that happened, he came on the radio and he was shouting at me, "Easy Tiger, Easy Tiger, you have done a new lap record. You have a new lap record, Easy." And you know, to get a German to speak English, that's pretty good. And that sort of made my debut a lot easier. But it was the whole thing. Michele, Stefan, Reinhold Joerst, and the little team. There was only 12 mechanics, you know. Now, I mean, the last race with Audi, with three cars, we were 140 mechanics. So you see, to being part of all that progressing over these 20 years has been absolutely amazing. But still, my highlight is when we then eventually won Le Mans, because the works Porsches broke down, and we put them a lot under pressure, and taking the lead 2 hours before the end, when I was driving, giving the car to Michele, was fantastic. But it was what happened afterwards. When the car had passed scrutineering, we were having a barbecue up at the small little camper and the tent. And the team was there having their Weiss beer and Bockwurst, Frankfurter, Weisswurst, whatever, on the grill. And I had gathered enough confidence that I had the beer, and I could see in their faces, because they were the original mechanics of Joerst Racing when Reinhold was driving himself. And I got sort of the respect that they looked at me with a little bit more respect than in the beginning, obviously, but they embraced me well. Then I went up, put a finger in the back of Jürgen, and I said, Jürgen, next year is possible to have the brake pedal a little bit more back in German, and he couldn't help himself. So that moment is my dad always loves when I tell about that, because I think it means it's such a small moment in time, but having the first race to go so well for sure has been very important for my career at Le Mans.
What was the car like? Because it was quite an old car by that point compared to the GT1s. How was the car to drive?
The car was pretty physical to drive. I mean, you as an expert can tell me a little bit about where it goes from in terms of it was originally designed by TWR with Ross Brawn, being sort of a Jaguar, being going into the Porsche works, trying to go to Daytona. Yep. US got the, anyway, a long story, but the car, physical to drive, no power steering, right-hand drive car, unsynchronized hedge pattern, Porsche gearbox, obviously, and open car. And the thing was, what I learned from that race, which was probably what was close to bite me, to be honest, because sitting in the seat and saying it's perfect, or it's not. So when you're driving and with Michele's seat, I have put a little bit into it for sure, but if you're not sitting well in a 24-hour race, it's going to bite you a lot. And I look like a timberman, a blind timberman after my fingers were completely, I was completely worn out. I think we had a Formula 3000 test 3 or 4 days later at Mugello, and I was completely finished still for that test.
I was going to ask actually whether it's, you know, because you did the four stints during the night, and you did a lot of the driving. You'd been racing in Formula 3000, which is very physical, but nothing like the 24 hours at Le Mans. I mean, you obviously weren't physically prepared, I guess. Did you know that going into it, or was that a sort of a shock how physical it was?
I think I was physically prepared, but I was not mentally in that prepared in that sense. And the car, you know, not sitting completely perfect in the car. And the thing back then, the surface on the road had a lot of rots from chocks and lorries. So obviously with the white tires and the Porsche not being so, having a lot of aerodynamics, it was a heavy car. So it was always pulling on the straights, of course on the camber on the road, because today it's new asphalt more or less around the track. Back then it was not. So in that sense it was much more physical. It was more bumpy as well, and obviously it's a long race. And if you're always tense, you obviously are tense for a long time. So I think it was more that I was driving too tense. I wanted it too much to make sure that nothing would go wrong. I'm for sure driving more relaxed other times when I'm in the race car than that particular year, because I know I needed it.
When you first sort of went out and you're doing the night stints and you know you're going down the Mulsanne, the car's dropping into these ruts, you're coming across traffic everywhere. There's slow cars, fast cars. There's good drivers, bad drivers. Was there not a part of you, having come from Formula 3000, thinking, What am I doing here? What is this race? You know, I mean, obviously you knew about it. You knew how
no, because that was. You don't think that. Because when you enter it, you're entering it to do like it is, and you don't start to think about what you should do differently. You try to get on with it in the best possible way. But it's for sure it's great challenges, and you have really to be aware. And I tell you, I'm not saying every lap, but many times. You have that these situations where you have to commit, and because as I said, in 18 years with all the laps you told me, only 10 maybe has been clear laps. The rest is probably average of passing 4, 5, 6, or 7 cars per lap.
So Jack, just before I come to you, we were talking before the podcast that Tom's done over 2,000 racing laps at Le Mans, which is an amazing number of laps. Sorry, Jack, we wanted to ask something.
Yeah, we were talking the other day in the office about the difference between teams like Go and Champion and Yost. Why did Yost succeed and teams like Go and Champion didn't have the same success?
Yeah, To be honest, I think that's very similar, because only two times I have been driving at Le Mans as a one car entry, and the first time was with Joost in the Porsche in the beginning, and then it was with Team Go in 2004. And there is something very, very nice for the drivers to know that in that pit, in that garage, everything, all the concentration, all the hard work and focus goes into one car. But of course, I also see it makes the team owners, the team managers very vulnerable with only one car in that sense. But there is something very, very nicely about it. So I think that's where I would compare that to. Actually, with Champion, we were two cars and two, as always, without in the teams, equally strong cars going into the race. And we had that year in 2005 to fight the faster Pescarolo cars, which were, beforehand, easy going to win, because we had 50 kilos extra as a ballast weight, success ballast put into the car with a narrower rear wing. So on speed, we couldn't win. But again, efficiency, strategy, and taking risk, and it paid off. It happened to be that our car won that race. But that was with the last victory with the Audi R8, which won five times. I was very privileged to be part of the driver team every time it won. But that car was at that time very well tested due to the 3 years with Team Joost and Audi of the works teams era of 2001 and 02.
I'm going to sort of come back to Le Mans in a bit, but I was chatting to Simon Aaron, our features editor, in the office yesterday, and he told me this wonderful story of him in 1996 in the press room at Spa. And you wandered in, this is for the Formula 3000 round, and he said, well, what are you doing here? And you said, well, I'm just sort of trying to learn the track, really. And Simon then introduced you to his computer game on his laptop, and you did two laps. Apparently you had a massive off in a Tyrrell at Eau Rouge on the game, and then your second lap was faster than anything he'd ever managed. Anyway, from this, you then went out and put it on pole. Is that how you remember it?
That's how I remember it. But I also remember from my time in Japan with Jacques Villeneuve, and he was also first time at Spa, and he said he had learned it on a computer game, so it was very good. But it was a bit late. I tried to learn it from Simon, but for sure he must have given me some good tips. So I was on pole, and Jacques was on pole in F1. So it worked quite well for us first time out. Even though that I didn't win the race, I think I finished second or third. I was passed up the hill on the first lap out of Eau Rouge. So I might have taken Eau Rouge a little bit too careful, unfortunately. But that's I will blame. You can blame Simon for that. Otherwise,
yeah, thanks,
I might
Simon.
Have won.
That's brilliant. We've mentioned the racing in Japan and things. As I think whenever I hear you talk about your racing in Japan, you obviously absolutely loved that period of your career, because you're out there for quite a long time, weren't you? And I've got a sort of list here. You won the Japanese Championship in F3, the World Final at Fuji's, you were second at Macau, touring cars, twice runner-up in the Championship, and you also raced Nissan Skylines. There's a load of racing out there.
A little bit of GT racing with Toyota Supra, yeah, as well, yeah.
What was it that was so fun out there? Was it that period of your life when the sort of the world was slightly at your feet, or what was it?
After when I won the German F3, I was testing for a few good teams. One I introduced from Zanardi, testing in Mugello, doing things, but they needed a budget. Not a lot of budget, but I didn't have it. So I went to Japan. Japan is good for all the drivers going there. Infrastructure of a lot of different circuits, a lot of different kinds of circuits. In Europe, we have to be careful. We don't make every circuit try to look very similar. In Japan, they got a lot of factories, from tire manufacturers, car manufacturers, and in all the sense, they got a fantastic fantastic motorsport country for that. And we, as Guardians, living over there at that time, I mean, as you know, I came in Formula 3 with Toms, and there was Jacques Villeneuve, Richard Rydell, Anthony Reid, Richard Dean, Nico Palhares, Eugenio Visco. I miss a few, sorry. But then in 3000, it was Mauro Martini, Jeff Krosnov, Roland Ratzenberger, Ross Cheever, Andrew Gilbert Scott, Mauro Martini, Eddie Irvine, Johnny Herbert, Marco Apicella, just to mention a few. So a lot of great drivers and a great camaraderie there. And we were not necessarily fighting over on the track, but we were not fighting over the seats outside of the community. So we spent quite a lot of times together doing the traveling between the different circuits, and I think I have a lot to thank Japan and the country and the infrastructure of racing.
It still seems to be a bit of a hub for sports car drivers, isn't it, Japan? So Super Formula, you've got Lotterer, Duval. Is that something you've had an influence on from inside Audi, saying?
I remember that I don't have to take credit for that, but we have certainly Joe Hausner from Audi, and I've always explained with that the drivers who succeed in Japan, they have to go, in my mind, through harder sort of tasks. They to produce these results, what they have done in Japan. To go so much away from home, the motivation of doing it in a completely different world, it takes a mental a bit of a different attitude, and I think that's a good attitude to have in a race car driver, to be able to focus exactly on what you have to do in the car within the team you are in, and to go through the school of driving in Japan at the different tracks, at the different opportunity with the testing, and you just have to check a few circuits, like I'm sure Audi did, and with Dr. Ulrich and Joe Hausner, and I sort of told them the drivers who are fast at these circuits, these are what you have to look at, and it's clearly that Loic, André Lotterer, and Trelieu, they came out through that with very high notes.
Sorry, you drove the Group C out there as well, didn't you? The Toyota Group C.
No, I did one race, I did some testing. I think I did some testing with Toyota back then. You can ask them if it's true or not, but I did the traction control test of the Toyota TSO 10 at the Yamaha test circuit. And if I look today at how that circuit and how fast I went around that track and tried to spell to something like safety and being young, and then I think I might have done the testing, because some of more experienced drivers have said maybe they couldn't do that day. They were busy with other things. but I did that, and I for sure this is something which helped me when I had my debut at Le Mans, clearly. But driving that car was fantastic, and I was hoping to get into Le Mans that year, when I was then told no, I should focus on winning the Japanese F3 championship. But I was close to getting to Le Mans with Toyota back then. So already back then, I was thinking, as a very young man, to go to Le Mans one day. But the race we did was in Mina, and the pairing was with Eddie Irvine and Jacques Villeneuve, and we were actually going well. We could have won the race, but we lost a gear, I think third gear or fourth gear, I'm not sure. But we finished on the podium. It was nice times.
It's interesting that you're saying that you're already looking at Le Mans, that, you know, when you were competing in F3. And I think it's sort of happening again nowadays, because there are so few seats in Formula 1 and sports cars is such a valid career still. When was it that you decided actually 100% sports cars? Because obviously you're doing your F1 testing. Was there a moment when you thought, you know what, this is what I want to be doing?
It was always parallel, because the first success I had at Le Mans, the years with US Porsche, and then with BMW and with Williams. I mean, I still remember that call from Frank. Hello, Tom. It's Frank Williams here. I would love you to test our cars at Magny-Cours. That was great, and I think I did well. And I'm sure Patrick Head have helped push in that direction, because he came out with to support John Russell and the team when we did the testing BMW LMR, the V12, the one with a single roll hoop, which we won Sebring and Le Mans within 99. So it always focused on Le Mans, and being with a manufacturer has always been very important for me. I realized that's what I have to do if I can jump onto Formula One. I mean, you cannot give up a dream like that, which I had as a childhood dream. But in reality, I've been very, very fortunate. And it led to that meeting with Dr. Ulrich in end of 99, because they were at the pit garage next to us when I drove for BMW Snitzer with the Williams car. And when I signed with Dr. Ulrich, I think that time I wanted to go 100% sports cars. But even that was when I was testing for Michelin in Formula One the following year. So I always said, okay, if it happens, it happens, but only if it's a good competitive team and they would support me for more than a year. And that didn't come up. But I'm blessed with sports cars. And I think sports cars for a driver is healthier, is better. And I certainly have enjoyed that entire time very much.
It's interesting because I think I remember reading somewhere that you obviously approached by Audi and they showed you a drawing of the R8.
Yeah.
And you actually signed the deal that day.
We gave a handshake.
Yeah, a handshake. That's much better than actually signing a deal, isn't it?
Yeah.
What was it that, I mean, I know Audi is this huge manufacturer, loads of success in motorsport before their sort of recent Le Mans victories, but what was it that made you shake that hand? Because if it was me, I would be like, well, it's a lovely sketch, but...
Yeah, Dr. Ulrich told me they will have a long-term commitment. I never expected it to be, for Audi, it's more than 20 years. I didn't expect that, but he sort of said, we're in it and we will try to win it. And he showed me around and meeting the people and at Ingolstadt, and the people, it just gelled immediately. I just had that feeling that these people wants to very much to win and to win the right way and work hard for it. And that feeling, that gut feeling, absolutely, I was blessed with the best decision I have made in racing. And of course, Dr. Ulrich attracted a lot of others, and he mentioned that the other drivers he was thinking about bringing in. I mean, I was partnered with Bela Piro, but of course there was McNish coming in, Michele Alboreto in the very beginning, Aiello Ortelli. There was a lot of good names, and of course with Capello as well. This then developed forward from there.
Because the Audi success at Le Mans, I was thinking about this the other day. That actually, when you look at the history books, you've got this run of victories at Le Mans 24 Hours. But actually, what was so amazing about this era is that they weren't. If you look at it, you might think it was an easy thing to go out and win Le Mans with it, but it wasn't. There were so many close races. There were so many times when you were the underdogs. You mentioned Pescarolo. There was the year when Peugeot was ultimately a lot quicker. Do you think that you've lived through sort of one of the golden eras and competed in one of the golden eras at Le Mans? I mean, there's been so many, but it seems to me that really the last, these 20 years have been absolutely fantastic. Is that how it's felt from the inside?
Yes, I mean, obviously the time when you are there, it's when you have to do your utmost, and I certainly have enjoyed it very much. It's a privilege to work with great co-drivers and great teams, but every race, I can talk for hours about every race and tell how close it was, how the decision was made, or how there's so much to it. And many times it's also won by the mechanics. When we had a pit stop, I have to change something. I mean, if it takes 3 minutes, we might win Le Mans. If it takes 4 minutes, there's no chance we can win. You know, there's so much to it. And I think that's why, for example, like 2008, where there was no way we were going to win and the press was all over us. We couldn't win in 2008 because the pretest, we were 3.7 seconds slower than the Peugeot. But, you know, with the rain, with the whole thing of not accepting to give up, but still, even though listening to all that, humiliation of not being able to win, we didn't want to accept it. And yeah, the race has it that there was rain and through the night we passed the Peugeot, and at Capello, McNish and myself, we won. And everyone within the team, I've never felt so that everyone was so proud and so happy. You know, some of the victories has been fantastic for a lot of people within the team, but there it was everyone. And to be in that state of of was absolutely fantastic.
So that sort of knack that Audi had to win races, was that always there, or did it develop the ability to win races when it shouldn't have done? Because it still had it last year. It was still beating the Porsche when really it was the slower car. So
I think, of course, there's a lot of pressure when you're competing for a manufacturer, because there's expectations to win when you're going through the decisions early on, when you're planning, when you're working on it. So you're racing with that pressure as well. But there's always that natural hunger of sportsmanship and gamemanship within the team, and that bodes well from the teams, which has primarily with Joost, but also the other teams which have raced for Audi. That DNA, I think, very much comes from Ingolstadt and Neckarsulm. It's hardworking people, and at first they can glance a little bit like, yeah, he's pretty hard on you. But actually, there's a lot of soul behind that face. There was people who have asked me, Dr. Ulrich seems very stern to me, and I think they're joking, because he's actually absolutely the opposite when you know him. But then again, I think the competition at Le Mans and the race itself, the respect that people have there when they go racing, I think that gets the best out of people. So for me, that's why it's the best race, because you can't sort of...
You can't fudge a win at Le Mans,
no,
really.
To me, not.
Yeah. Did you find it more difficult to beat your teammates then than to beat Peugeot in a way?
Sometimes yes, because of course with equal... you have to make sure that you, in the way of preparing the car, everything was equal with Audi. We start with equal terms, and I think that's also already, you can take that away when you're setting up the team with Dr. Ulrich, is that you try to work the best you can with your car and your engineers, but you got the same tools, and I think that's very good. But for sure, it's also has been both positively stressful and great competition. But to keep the camaraderie and the competition together, I think that bodes in respect. And I think with Audi, this is something which have been managed over the years. Of course, there has been races or situation or laps or overtakings where the radio can get hot, but this is in the name of the competition. And Dr. Ulrich has always let that happen. He just don't want us to... as you say, to have see two cars going off together.
Do you see that in the Porsches now as well, that they're kind of out to beat each other more than they are?
No, not necessarily, but also last year, I mean, it was Toyota's race until it was not, and it couldn't be more late than that. So everyone, of course, felt sorry for them, incredibly sorry for them there. But for sure there is competition within the driver teams, but it has to be handled good. Otherwise, it can very much penalize, a team. But you see that everywhere. That's not only in the WEC. This you see in F1, you see it in DTM, you see it everywhere.
Now, we could talk about, well, as you say, we could talk about each individual Le Mans for an entire hour, but I would really like to talk about British Touring Car Championship. because now I'm going to preface this with the fact that I love Knockhill. I was born and brought up just near it. But you had won Le Mans. This is in 2000. You then, what was it like being part of this National British Championship and going to places like Knockhill, a fantastic circuit, but it's not Le Mans, is it? Was it quite a shock to the system? Was it, I mean, sort of getting used to that, or was it just good fun?
It was good fun. It was with West Surrey Racing and with Dick Bennett's team, and the team manager Malcolm Swetnam. The thing was to come to England was that we should travel, I think, in February, just with an interim car, just to do a few laps on every circuit. So we sort of did a tour. And I went to Knockhill, and the weather was not
terrible.
It was actually it looked a little bit like Switzerland in terms of not green but white. And we went to Croft and things like that. So that was my very first time there. But I loved the racing track, and I remember I had a fantastic fight with Rydell. He was in the Mondeo that year, and at Knockhill, and it was good track as well. I love the Alton Park. I think that my first win came at Alton Park. It should have come at Brands Hatch, but as you have a driver over here, I forgot his name and I don't want to mention it, but you know, Jason the something. Pluto or something.
Something after a planet, Mercury.
Yeah, something like that.
But you were successful in winning both of the last two rounds at Silverstone, and that was part of the night race.
I mean,
I know this might be sound like a very obvious question, but did the night racing at Le Mans help that, or was it just a totally different experience? And
it did, but it was about to go wrong. I think I won the first race from wherever I came from, and then started the night race on pole. And I got away clean, and I remember I was leading, but they kept telling me on the radio to switch on the lights. But that I just had apparently just a little bit of position lights on. I didn't have the high beam on, and it didn't work. I couldn't switch it on. But then at some stage they were about to put me a mechanical failure on it, and Malcolm was talking to them, and then it just happened that I passed and I was leading, so I had a clear track, but then I just did the fastest lap, and Malcolm said I did the fastest lap, so how can, if it's, there's no light, he's leading. So he managed to team managing wise to do a Jason Plato to talk ourselves out of it. So the last victory was actually done just with position lights, but there was a bit of floodlight, so I don't know, it might be blessed from my mom and dad's good eyesight, which has helped, but things are happening a bit slow on track in British touring car, even though that I have to say it was very physically and with the different kinds of circuit it was. It was a splendid championship, but to finish the super touring era off with winning is something which made not only the team very proud, but also myself.
They were, I mean, they must have been fantastic cars to drive. I mean, it's obviously so different to, you know, the sports cars you were driving, but they were, in terms of tin tops,
yeah,
they must have been great round somewhere like Knockhill, or you know, or
yeah, front wheel drive, very light on the rear. So I mean, the temperature had an incredibly influence. So when you were testing these cars in low temperature, they were really, really edgy, and they were breaking away very easily. They were great cars to drive, but for sure, it's not the real pleasure. It was more the physical aspect of out racing each other, trying to outfox each other, and always having contact. In Britain, you would not be able to pass cars or be passed without contact. And that was a good thing to learn, but I was learning that during the season. So I would maybe have loved to have done another season and then in total maybe being able to fight for the championship. But I still love my time doing that one season. And
We've got lots of listeners' questions, so I should ask some of them. There's one here from Anthony Jenkins. Nice question about your time at Le Mans. And he's wondering what your favourite moment of all was, time of day, location.
Favourite moment was Jürgen. Is it possible to get the brake pedal a little bit back? That's a famous moment. But I mean, for sure, when you get into the morning where the race has settled and you have been in the race a long time, and if you can start to see it's going well, there's nothing better than that. In the dusk, sunrise, being in the car, everything is going well. Of course, there's still plenty of hours to go, but that's sort of a very, very nice time of the race. And you see that everything is a bit slow in terms of spectators, less people on the tribunes, less people, even some are sleeping around some places. But then they put the kind Danish people, they put the flag, that they're still holding the flag a few places. You can see that. And obviously, the Audi is running smoothly. That's the favorite, I think, time and moment in the race, apart from taking the checkered flag for sure.
And winning, yeah. It's something that I'd love to talk a little bit about is Sebring. You had so much success there, 6 wins. Before we talk about the track and sort of what it's like, I saw a video the other day, and you mentioned John Hindhoff, who hosted the evening last night, who took you on a, flying lap of Sebring. And your face, it is, if you're listening, just Google this video because it's absolutely brilliant. And you, I've never seen anyone look so nervous in their lives. What? How did that come about, and why did you say yes? Do you regret it?
I was invited to the Hall of Fame, to Sebring. So I was just arriving that day. I think this is just before the night practice on the Thursday before Sebring last year. And Martin Paas arranged that I should drive John Heindhoff around the circuit and tell a little bit about the past. That's wonderful. So I arrived with Martin and no Heindhoff. But then he arrives just 2 minutes before we were supposed to meet in a car. And because we had only track access right there, he said, jump in. And I said, jump in? I mean, no, I'm driving. And that's the first time I understood he was driving. And I said, no way. I thought
that was scripted. I didn't realize that.
It was, but not told to me. And I think it was me. So I said, I'm not going in next to you, John. Are you crazy? You're a commentator. You do great commentary. You're the voice, but you're certainly not the driver. And he started to, you know, come on in, we are doing this. And we can only do a certain amount of laps. All right, I jump in. And he goes out of turn 17 and he goes, welcome, we have Tom blah, 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 on board, we're going on. And then he floors it. And I go, and just going down the straight into turn one, he sort of wanted me to answer. And I stop. I think they edited it all out and I said, you go slow because I cannot concentrate about trying to give you some decent, I don't trust you. And that sort of goes around. I think they edited a lot of things out. And John is sort of going over, I mean, I tried to explain him a little bit about which apex he has to hit. So it was... It was hilarious. I know he's taking license. I know he will go to Nürburgring. That's fine, but I don't want to go with him in the car. Absolutely not necessarily.
Brilliant. I mean, Sebring, it is. I mean, it's a very specific track, isn't it? Because it's really bumpy, and it still is. It's not like Le Mans that's sort of resurfaced and smooth and.
I think not compared to Le Mans, but for sure Le Mans has developed over the years. But Sebring, not really. I mean, there are circuits like the old Nürburgring. There are circuits like some circuits in Japan, but Macau, Po. But Sebring the same. I mean, to be honest, I spoke a bit with Sir Stirling Moss at Goodwood, and the circuit layout is very much the same like back then. Of course, there's barriers, there's some other chicanes, but it's the actual what we're driving on, the concrete, is the same. And it's very challenging, yeah, for the car, but also for the line of always having to pass, because with the traffic there has been at the races, it's a very mental, tough race, and we all love it. I mean, all the people competing at Sebring, they love that track. And in a way, when you're getting there on a test day, it looks quite ugly. But from a racing perspective, when you are there and looking for the ideal line, it's absolutely beautiful. And when you fill it up with 100,000 spectators over the weekend, and they are into the Sioux, into Turn 10, it's going crazy. That's splendid.
Would you agree that it's more challenging to do 12 hours of Sebring than 24 hours of Le Mans? A lot of people say it's the most physical of the races.
I wouldn't. They are very, very, very strong, both of them. But certainly Le Mans is harder in many ways. But that's for the length of the race, for sure. If you compare 24 hours of Sebring with 24 hours of Le Mans, it will be tougher. But there's a good chance that if you have a good race with your car, technically, mechanically, when things are working after 12 hours, and some of the times we have tested, going on to test even further at Sebring, then you have a very strong package and you can rely on going into maybe fine-tune and find even more speed for Le Mans, which is needed there. Because with the speeds at Le Mans, a small things can have a very, very big outcome with the speech you are doing there. At Sebring, there's just a lot of walls, a lot of concrete, a lot of bumps, and obviously a lot of dirt, sand, and also a lot of confusions with slower cars.
Must be quite difficult to avoid the bumps after 12 hours to keep missing. Isn't there a big bump at the end of the last hairpin?
So the most difficult 2017. There's a big bump in the middle, but it's literally bumpy everywhere. So of course you need to run a sort of a softer setup, and you know with the aerodynamically advanced cars we have nowadays. I mean, running a car softer creates the platform movement, and then you have the aero kicking in. So for sure the cars are on the edge a lot at Sebring to get that rhythm, and also the build up of grip over the race at Sebring over the 12 hours in the racing line is quite phenomenal, because when you come for the beginning of the week on the concrete, there's no rubber, but when you during the week it just builds up so much grip on the racing line, and then a lot of marbles offline as well. So it's certainly a very easy race to be out of within a fraction of a second.
I'm going to take a couple more questions. One from Jamie Smith here, and he'd love to hear your thoughts on the current LMP1 field. Do you think the category can survive in its current format? Because obviously, you know, Audi has now dropped out, and when you look back at 99 when you were there, Mercedes, Toyota, Nissan, Audi, BMW, you know, there's loads of manufacturers in the top class. Very few now. What are your thoughts on the current state of play?
It's good. It's a very healthy. It's a great championship, and I'm sure there will be other manufacturers looking at coming in when Audi left. But also you see the depth of the championship in total from the GT cars, the GTLM, the LMP2 cars, and now it's interesting to see how it's all, let's say. As you know, a racing driver is not involved with politics, but I would say from America, from the great Daytona they had with the DPI cars, and see how it's all going to mingle, because for me it's the best kind of racing there is, as I mentioned before, healthy, the environmental, the way we are, the paddocks, it's just the best kind of racing. There's constantly overtakings due to the classes as well, and within the classes the competition is incredibly strong. The fact that with the tire manufacturers you can develop and try to race something which you can be spot on the limit for a long time, and if not, then you better get on with it and work with it. So in that sense I think it's healthy, and I think it will of course it has a little bit of a shock for the people, for us as well, with the Audi pullout. But you really have, or in my mind, we have to thank, or I certainly thank Audi for what they have done for my time and career at Le Mans. So thanks for that.
Yeah, was it a shock when Audi told you that? I mean, I guess you didn't hear through the sort of normal channels of news, you must have been cool, but was it a shock when Audi withdrew, or did you see that coming?
Of course, it will not continue forever, so I sensed something, but I was actually working for Audi in Dubai, Abu Dhabi, with Audi Sport, with the heritage of us. We're opening a new branch down there on the day when it happened, and I just knew about it a few hours before the media. So yes, that was a shock. The timing was a shock. But as you know, a big manufacturer, there's no bad timing, there's no good timing, but it has to be one pull. And I think that was done early enough that everyone could get on with because of course for drivers, for teams, it is a major thing, but of course also for the organizers, absolutely. But it couldn't have been done in a better way than what Audi did.
Yeah. Now, am I right in thinking that you're in charge of driver fitness at Audi at the moment? Is that, did you still play quite an active role in the driver fitness? So in terms of you telling lots of 20-year-olds to how fit they need to be and things.
No, I'm happily involved with them, and I call it, I'm sort of the supporter, motivator when we are doing the our fitness weeks with then I'm there, and I'm very helpful doing the programs, doing what we would like to do, and with the doctor Vincenzo Tota, we make sure that we have a good strategy for that. And now after Dr. Ulrich stepped a little bit back, it's with Dieter Gass. So I'm involved in that. But at the end of the day, who is involved? That's themselves, and the drivers are doing a very good program daily, and are very strong. So in that sense, it's an easy job for me, but it's something which is fantastic to be involved with after my career, because it's something which I pushed for myself a lot when I was competing. You had to be on your top form all the time when you go into these great cars.
And am I right, you're also the president of the FIA Drivers Commission?
Yes.
Yeah. So could you just tell me what is it, and what is it that you do? Because I think there's sort of an element of mystery in terms of exactly what goes on, just for everyone listening, because there's lots of really important work you do, but I just don't think it's reported that widely.
The Drivers Commission, we are a great commission, which we are, in that sense, we are having meetings 3-4 times a year, where we are discussing all sorts of things which comes from the, let's say, the different commissions under the FIA. It can be circuit commission, it can be a single seater commission, it can be different way. There will be a lot of sort of issues which they would like our views on. So we're trying to push that and giving the best possible answer, solution. And sometimes we go a little bit further than that, but we are not regular commission. We are supporting and advising, and there's a lot of subjects to be discussed during the year, in terms of regulation, in terms of circuit, in terms of a lot of aspect. And obviously we have the commission are from karting, from off-road, from rallycross, from touring cars, from GT to Formula One, and the WEC.
So on drivers, who do you think is the next sports car star, in a way?
There's good drivers at the moment, absolutely. I can mention a lot of names,
yep.
But because I think the competition is very, very, very good, very strong at the moment. And last year we saw a lot of drivers progress really well, and I still feel a part of it, even though it's only 2 years ago since I left it. But I can still sense it and understand in a way how it's going. And I think the races we saw last year, there was very, very strong commitment and abilities from drivers.
Talking about stiff competition. Am I right in thinking you're about to drive a Rover SD1 at Goodwood members meeting?
Apparently, but yeah.
Just apparently, have you not heard about all the details yet?
No, but that's usual. I have a lot of faith in the only thing I require. I have been at the Goodwood Revival. I have been 5 times and driving different cars. And apart from the first time, when the days before the Silverstone WEC race, I went and I tested this Austin Westminster A95, which I drove the first time there. I did a test with them. All the other times, I see the car just before we do the driver's briefing in the tent in front of the Goodwood House. And the first time I drive the car is in the official qualifying. And I think that's where it should be. So that's what I do every year. And now it will be the first time with a members meeting. And yes, I heard it was a Rover. I heard it was a Triumph Dolomite, but apparently it's a Rover. It's a British car, British heritage. So I will for sure go and try to treat that well. And I don't know if it's a race, a demonstration or whatever, but
I think it's a race.
Yeah, but yeah. Normally, even though a demonstration, it will end up in a yeah, in a race. But exactly. It's just fantastic that at least with the Revival, that you step back in time before you were born to drive cars, which obviously requires a completely different driving style, and that's just lovely to do that now after I'm retired. So it extending my career sort of both ways. And the older you get, the more you get for the history and the heritage of our sport. It's it's always good to be invited with Lord Marsh. And actually this year I tried to attend all the, his three events, members meeting now for the first time, and Festival of Speed, and then later the revival.
I just love the thought of you getting from your Audi LMP1 car into an Austin Westminster. Could you think of two more different cars in the world than those two? Probably not.
Probably not. I mean, but they... I went in the wrong side of it, actually. And one time in another car, I tried to do the gear change, and I opened the door.
They're fantastic events, the Goodwood events, aren't they? And the circuit actually is, from your perspective, it is a fun circuit. It's a very fast circuit, but it's also quite challenging, is it not?
Yeah, it's a bit like, I like that thing that it's green next to, and you're treated with respect. So you don't go in and go sort of flat out and run a little bit wide in terms of track limits and come back. There's not sort of that thing there, which I like. It's a bit like when you came to Le Mans in the early days. You built up the pace and feel the car and try to sort of feel the car a little bit below limit, and then you go. And that, for me, that produces a lot better races as well, because there is this chemistry within the field of drivers when you have that natural respect for circuits.
And the other owner, the owner's cars as well. So.
This you tend to forget right after you said, thank you very much.
we'll cut that bit out, otherwise your over SD1 drive might disappear. We've only got a few minutes left, but I wanted to do a sort of a new segment on these talk shows, and that's to ask sort of four questions that we're going to ask every guest that we have this year. So they're sort of quite general questions, but hopefully we'll get some interesting answers. There's actually someone who's actually asked a question regarding this first one. So the first question is, one car and one track, which car would you take to which track to do 10 laps?
I think I answered that question in...
It was the Austin Westminster, wasn't it? A good word.
Yeah. No, but it's not a fair question. I have just been blessed with driving so many different cars. I would love to step back in and drive again.
Do you think the circuit would be Le Mans, though? Is that always going to hold that special place in your heart?
Yeah, but right now, I still remember Le Mans after so many laps. I would probably think back to go maybe to Macau. Why not go back to Macau? Maybe in the first time I was there, in the Rolt RT31 with a Volkswagen. I don't know, but it's just, I would like to go a little bit further away from what I have done, just to get that sensation again. Because I drove at Le Mans the 2000 Audi R8 at the anniversary when I was Grand Marshal. What was it? 2 years ago. I drive 40 meters in it. I just have to drive up where I have to start, and everything feels normal. I feel the sensation like how it was 15 years earlier, and that was that's a nice sensation to get that. And that's why I would like to go even further back to try something. If you're talking about the best car, there's so many things. One is the most beautiful, elegant. One is the most aggressive. One is the aerodynamically beast, in a way. That's a car down here in the lobby. The Formula One test, maybe with the Williams, was probably the best car when I drove in terms of Formula One cars. We're driving that in Magny-Cours. The Michelin tests were, of course, with the groove tires. So that was a bit of a challenge there. But so many cars.
Yeah. Okay. So and the second question is, who has influenced you the most during your career?
My dad, and then a lot of great. My dad definitely have inspired me the most, and he has always been my sort of, in that sense, greatest critics, but also greatest supporter in that way. But then I have been blessed with so many people along the way of people I could trust, and I felt that they really wanted to help me. And then all my co-drivers, because all my co-drivers in the races or teammates, they have had a great influence as well as how everything has turned out.
Did you work much with Norbert Singer when you were at Porsche?
No, because when I was at Porsche, it was a private team. So actually, we were in a way against his works team that year. But I know Norbert Singer and I respect him, and obviously from all the things he has done, mainly pre my time at Le Mans, is obviously fantastic, and that's obviously a golden era of what he has been involved with and producing. So I always stop and have a very short conversation with him when I meet him in the paddock, very briefly, and a smile and hi and see you later.
Because I know he kind of made that car into a Le Mans winner, didn't he? The year before, he kind of fixed it in a way because it wasn't too drivable. So I guess you owe him that again, I guess.
Yeah, no, in that sense, yeah, for sure he's worked with Jürster in that sense. But I didn't work directly with him on any race car. I know Alan McNish does, did, and he speaks also, he speaks fondly about Norbert, for sure.
So final couple of questions. When was there a period in time when you knew that motor racing was going to be your life? Was that very early age? Because obviously, you know,
it was not an early age. In short, I was born on a gas station. My dad was driving, but only when he sort of could afford it. And sometimes he had to jump a race or not. And otherwise they had to repair the car and go again. So I grew up watching over the fence, my dad driving different cars, starting with a Volvo, started some Ford Escorts, Mach 1s, and fantastically. And then he actually did Paris-Dakar with the Tolman team, driving the truck. And he came here to do a lot of hot rod races. I think he was introduced to Tolman because Barry Lee came sometimes to Denmark. And my dad beat him a few times. And I think in that sense, he sort of recommended my dad to this team. But that was all my influence in the early days. But I'm not blessed with a lot of money, so all the times of eating the muesli, trying to hopefully be fit and taking good opportunities in karting and progressing from there, my mom would go around the breakfast table and say, you know, Tom, in 10 million people, there might be one driver who can live of racing, so you need another education. So you sort of look up from the table and just get eye contact with your dad. And he'd just let the eye wander a little bit. And you, yeah, mom, you're right, I will look for something. And that's why I'm educated a bank clerk, bank assistant, because I didn't, after karting and winning Scandinavian, second in the world, and all these good karting results resulted in 1,000 days of not knowing if I was going to make it into racing. So Bertram Schäfer is very important for me. He signed me in German F3 1991, and he's very influential to me to make my pro career. Without that call, nothing might ever have happened. So I will never forget that, and not particularly that we won the first race in Zolder. It was the year after Schumacher won the German F3 Championship, and I won the first race in Zolder. And I never forget that he came with me on the podium, and he put the finger sort of behind me and said to me in German that Tom, du wirst deine Karriere machen, that you have proven you have the talent to make a career. And these words are also still in my mind. So I think that's the point you asked for.
Yeah. It must be the fastest bank clerk in the world.
I drove the bank bus at one time, and the lady was going with me. Was
quite nervous.
A little bit, yeah. Especially when the phone rang, because the phone is down in the bottom. And if I was driving to the next stop, she will have to walk back through. But there was a mirror, so when I could always do a little bit of jiggling, and she was sort of doing a tank slap. And, you know, for a woman working in the bank, it could look quite interesting.
I wonder whether John Hindhoff's lap round Sebring was payback for those early years in the bus. The final question, I think obviously talking about the banking clerk, you know, if you weren't a racing driver, what would you have been? I guess the banking career would have carried on. Or do you think you would have worked in racing somehow? I guess obviously with your being brought up around, you know, your dad racing and the garage and everything like that, there must have been a part of you that wanted to be involved in motorsport in some way, I guess, or maybe not.
Yeah, but the opportunities were not many from the city where I was from and things in that sense. So I might be, you know, short sleeves, tie, sitting at a bank clerk's desk. Well, looking very happy.
Yeah. Well, thankfully you weren't. What a fantastic career you've had. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. Extremely kind. Look forward to seeing you at Race Retro. Jack, thank you very much for joining us for your podcast debut. And Alan, as always, thank you so much for recording all of this, both on video and audio. If you'd like to ask questions, just do please leave comments, because we'll be back next month for another talk show, and we'll see you all then. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.